Many SMRs incorporate design components that are intended to just make them intrinsically safer, whether that's the way the fuel is constructed, whether that's the amount of intervention that on-site operators need to have in keeping the reactor going. But many SMRs leverage design features that just make them intrinsically safer.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is episode 097, number 97 of the Flux Capacitor. My guests today on the pod are
John Stackhouse, Senior Vice President, Office of the CEO, Royal Bank of Canada.
Vivan Sorab, Senior Manager, Clean Technology, Royal Bank of Canada.
John and Vivan joined me for a conversation about the RBC Climate Action Institute's recent report on the role SMRs, small modular reactors, will play in Canada's energy future. Think small, how Canada can make small modular reactors a priority. We discuss SMR technology, the state of progress in their deployment, and likely applications in Canada. We also discuss the path ahead, including the needed investments, Indigenous partnerships, and social license. John also gives an indication of issues the Institute is currently addressing. We close the conversation with Vivan and John's recommendations for additions to the Flux Capacitor Book Club. Here is my conversation with John Stackhouse and Vivan Sorab, recorded on Zoom in mid-May 2024. Vivan, welcome to the podcast. And John, welcome back to the podcast. You're a repeat guest that wasn't so long ago, but there's plenty for us to talk about. So why don't we jump right into it? But maybe start off with John. I guess the last time I saw you was a couple of months ago when the RBC Climate Action Institute was launching that flagship report, Climate Action 2024. Great report. But maybe if we could start off the podcast, because we didn't talk much about the Climate Action Institute when you were last on the podcast. Could you give a bit of a thumbnail sketch to the listener about what the Institute's all about and how it came about?
No, happy to. And thanks for having us back on the podcast, Francis. We launched the RBC Climate Action Institute, as it's called, about a year ago. In the spring of 2023, with the spirit of informing and inspiring Canada's journey to net zero. So as a bank, as the country's largest bank, we're doing a number of things in terms of our climate strategy. We're managing our own emissions in offices, travel, and data centers. Critically, we're working with clients in all sectors, but especially in the heavy emitting sectors, on their transition plans. And we have a whole client engagement framework that people are welcome to read on our website that outlines how we engage with heavy emitters and understand their strategies and help map that and track what we hope is progress. We have our own accountability through the Net Zero Banking Alliance and other affiliations like that. But it's more than us, it's more than any one entity, and as you know, it's more than any one sector. This is really a truly collective effort. And in that spirit, we felt we should be doing the best that we can with our strengths in data, in economics, in our exposure to different sectors, and exposure to every community across the country to share what we may be discovering with the public, with decision makers, on the many interesting and, frankly, challenging questions out there, and I'm sure we'll be getting into those. So that, in sum, is the spirit of the Climate Action Institute. It's to inform and inspire, but also engage. Yep. We want to be working on this with others, with our clients, with community groups, in that spirit of collective action.
Yeah. So earlier this year, I mentioned it, the Climate Action 2024 Double or Trouble report came out. Appreciated the opportunity to join you and a fairly broad community was there for the launch of that report. Could you maybe just give a quick thumbnail about what were some of the big messages out of that, and then we can tell the listener really why we're here and what we're going to talk about.
So the report is the first of what we intend to be an annual assessment of how Canada is doing. And there's some emissions data in there, as you'll find in many other reports. But we also want our annual look at Canada's progress to be informed by data from all sorts of activities, from capital mobilization, from corporate commitments, also from consumer behavior. What are we actually doing? In terms of driving, of travel, of spending, how are our attitudes changing, and also how is policy changing? Not announcements and pledges, but real policy action. So we'll continue that every year as a way of helping Canadians understand how we're doing on this journey to net zero. The first report, as you said, Climate Action 2024 was titled "Double or Trouble." And that comes from our analysis of capital flows. We did a big report a couple of years ago called the $2 trillion transition. You and I have spoken about this, Francis.
Yeah.
$2 trillion is the amount of capital that we estimate is going to be needed over 25 years invested. This is not tax and spend. This is investment capital to get to net zero. A lot of it in the electricity sector. Mm-hmm. Big number, but it's within our reach. So how are we doing? Well, we've gone from that. That works out to roughly $60 billion a year because that inflates over time.
Yep.
So how are we doing on that $60 billion? Well, in year one of our analysis, not so good. We are at about $22.5 billion last year. Mm-hmm. So we need to double the amount of capital, actually more than double, or we're going to be in trouble in terms of getting that zero.
Yeah.
Good news is, we're making progress. We've gone from $15 to $22.5 billion in 3 years. So good progress, Canada. We know many of the things that need to be done, but wow, we've got to really up our game. And I'm sure we'll get into some of the questions around that.
Yeah, yeah, and the report itself, and at the launch, we chatted very briefly. There was a sidebar on wind, and I asked you at the time, what about all of the other ways that we produce electricity from a non-emitting manner? And your response at the time was, oh, "Hang on, it won't be long." And so, kind of, that's where we are today, right? This new report. Maybe you can kind of set it up for us. I already had the précis on what the report is because I listened to your podcast, John. The latest edition of Disruptors was about small modular reactors. But yeah, can you set this up for the listener?
Yeah, we've just published a really good report, and the lead author is with us here. So I want to let him speak to it. But it's titled, maybe cheekily so, Think Small. And the spirit of that is, hey, Canada, like we need to think big in terms of our ambitions of what we do, but there's also power in small. And in this case, it's small modular nuclear reactors, SMRs. Great opportunity for Canada, great strengths that we've got as a country. And it will be, we think, an important component of the portfolio of energy sources that we're going to need and that blessedly we fortunately have as a country to literally power us to net zero. And I was excited to see just how big this small opportunity is. Vivan and I got to go to Darlington see the OPG site, of course, the great reactor that's or reactors that are in place, but also the construction site for the SMRs. Mm-hmm. So what a compelling vision of Canada's energy future.
Hey, well, let's Vivan, let's bring you into the conversation, and then, but maybe I'll start with a question about your journey. And I asked John this when he was on the podcast, but you know, the listener's always, I think, interested in getting a sense of what people's journey is to the role that they've got today. And the joke I always make is, you know, the role that you have today was when you were a little kid on the playground. Is this what you always dreamed of doing? So what was your journey to your role today?
Yeah, thanks, Francis. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me. My journey into clean technology has been a little nonlinear. And when I was a kid growing up, I really wanted to be a geologist, studying the earth, studying rocks. And I managed to become a geologist. I studied it in university, and then I went on to work for a major oil company for 3 years, telling them, you know, telling clients, telling operating partners where to drill their wells and how to produce oil and gas safely, economically, from various parts of the world. Mm-hmm. About 2 years into that journey, I had the opportunity to see how oil and gas technology was being applied to non-oil and gas applications.
Okay.
And I saw something that stood out to me back then and still does is how, with a little bit of creativity and a little bit of ingenuity, technology can really be applied to solve all kinds of problems. And something that stood out to me back then was how oil and gas technology was being used to study water flow and map the shallow subsurface in cities to help manage pipes and things and resources like that. And that got me thinking about what was outside of oil and gas. And that was about the time when the first early projections of EV demand growth were showing that the energy transition had come. And I started to think of where I could leverage my energy systems knowledge for a world that was changing, and renewables and clean tech seemed to be the place. So I made a bit of a career switch, and I moved into clean technology after that. And I've been in this space for about, I want to say 4 years now, and with RBC for the last 9 months.
Right. Okay. And then now in the past 9 months, you've been working on this report, Think Small. So let's talk small modular reactors, SMRs. So maybe, you know, given the work that you've done, can, you know, give the description for the listener about what makes a small modular reactor different from our traditional nuclear technology that we've seen now for 50, 60 years.
For sure. I think I'll start off. Let me break this down into each constituent term within small modular reactors. So let's start with the small. So when you think about a conventional nuclear reactor, these are massive engineering projects, mm-hmm. gigawatt in scale, powering 100,000 homes, taking years and sometimes decades to build at great expense.
Yeah.
SMRs, the small in SMRs, is pretty self-explanatory. You take a nuclear reactor, you scale it down. There is a definition out there that says that a small modular reactor is capped at about 300 megawatts and can go as small as 5 megawatts, so mm-hmm. About a third, roughly, of the size of a large nuclear power plant. But I should say that these are not firm definitions. There are nuclear reactors that are called SMRs that are rated at higher capacities. The UK, for example, has a design that's rated at about 475 megawatts or thereabouts. And there are some smaller reactors, less than 300 megawatts, that are not considered SMRs at all. Small reactors have been around for decades as well. They power things like aircraft carriers, submarines, mm-hmm. Spacecraft, for that matter. But those are not small modular reactors themselves, even though they are, in terms of size, actually pretty small. So that brings us to the next term, which is modular.
Yeah.
And modularity really refers to the possibility of these reactors to be manufactured in factories, borrowing mm-hmm. from principles that have enabled cost reductions in industries like aerospace, for example. And by manufacturing reactor components offsite, or by manufacturing entire reactors offsite and then moving them to the site of final deployment and installing them there or constructing them there, operators hope that they can lower the costs of nuclear substantially. And cost overruns have been an issue that have caused traditional nuclear reactors to fall a little bit behind in recent years in global energy. And finally, on the reactor front, SMRs are all based on nuclear flame process that large nuclear reactors are based on. There are multiple, there are many different designs. So the way the reactors work, they're all based on fission, but the way heat is harvested or the way the reactions are controlled varies substantially. And, mm-hmm. and oftentimes they leverage specific technologies that are quite advanced relative to currently deployed commercial designs. That being said, SMR designs, many of them are also based on existing large nuclear power plant technologies. So for example, the one that's being built outside of Toronto is the 10th iteration of a technology that's already deployed commercially in different parts of the world. It's just being scaled down. Oh. One of the reactors that's being deployed in New Brunswick is based off of a reactor design that operated in a research facility in the United States for three decades. So not all SMRs really are, altogether new. They might bring in new components in some ways, but oftentimes they're based on existing technologies. And the last thing that I'll say on SMRs is a little bit on safety. Many SMRs incorporate design components that are intended to just make them intrinsically safer, whether that's the way the fuel is constructed, whether that's the way operators, the amount of intervention that on-site operators need to have in keeping the reactor going. But many SMRs leverage design features that just make them intrinsically safer.
Right. So where are we at now with respect to kind of progress towards deploying SMRs? You mentioned for years we've had them on aircraft carriers and nuclear submarines, but what is the progress so far in terms of seeing their deployment elsewhere before we talk about what's happening here in Canada?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And SMRs are very much at a very early stage of deployment. I think by recent estimates, there are something like 98 SMR designs at various stages of commercialization around the world. But the vast majority of them are still at the design stage. They have not been put into the ground. There are two commercially operating SMRs in the world right now. One is in China and one is in Russia. The Russian one is a floating SMR. So it's on a barge that provides power to a port town in Siberia. And China is actually making good progress according to their press reports on building a third SMR, which commenced construction, I think, in 2021 and is already at a point where they've completed assembling the reactor core in just, about 2 years or just under 3 years. But besides that, SMRs are, still being licensed. We are very close to having a grid scale SMR being constructed in Canada. Mm-hmm. There's been an SMR in Argentina, a 25 megawatt SMR that's been where construction commenced a while ago, but hasn't really progressed very far. So we're still kind of at the early stages of deployment of technology of SMR technologies itself. Yeah. That being said, the renewed interest in nuclear power at COP28, 22 countries pledged that they were going to work to triple nuclear capacity by 2050. Mm-hmm. That renewed interest in growing nuclear power globally, and I think the global recognition that nuclear is a key component of achieving a net zero electricity system has has prompted many other countries to also start looking at small modular reactors. Poland has committed to installing, I think, 12 SMRs as part of their future energy system and in a mission to reduce reliance on coal. The United Kingdom is working on SMR deployments as well. China obviously has got a lot going on SMRs, and the United States is advancing projects of their own. So there's a lot of momentum all over the world right now to kind of commercialize these kinds of nuclear reactors.
Right. And so earlier you mentioned two different designs for two different provinces here in Canada. You mentioned the design in Ontario, the design in New Brunswick. So what's the state of deployment in Canada now?
Yeah. So it's actually really interesting, and Canada has is working very well in deploying a number of designs for different applications. Mm-hmm. And I'll start off by talking a little bit about the one that's closest to home here in Toronto, which is the 300 megawatt reactor that's being built at the Darlington nuclear facility. That reactor is currently going through the licensing process. An application for a license to construct the reactor has been submitted, and it looks like the reactor is actually on track to commence construction by 2025. And if all goes to plan, it should be complete by 2028 and online by 2029, feeding mm-hmm. power into Ontario's power grid. There are other designs as well. So out in Saskatchewan, a micro SMR of 5 megawatts, which could eventually, a design like that could eventually be deployed to power remote communities or power mines that would otherwise have to rely on diesel fuel. Recently got financing from the provincial government in Saskatchewan and could be online in the late 2020s. Another micro SMR design is being developed in partnership with a US-based technology vendor at Chalk River Laboratories in northwest of Ottawa. Mm-hmm. That design will hopefully be online by 2026 and will be the first of its kind micro design to come online in the world. And finally, there are two designs out in New Brunswick that are being commercialized that are using advanced cooling mechanisms and advanced fuel cycles to kind of drive their nuclear reactions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then what about applications? And you mentioned a couple of those potential applications, grid scale, electricity, remote communities. What are the applications that you would see as part of sort of the future of SMRs here in Canada?
Yeah, for sure. Great question. And I think this is really the one of the most interesting things about small modular reactors: their size, their technology characteristics, their flexibility really opens up applications for nuclear power that large nuclear power plants just may not have been able to achieve before. Yeah. So on the electricity front, Canada has a few large population centers, but many small ones mm-hmm. elsewhere, which are still large enough that they cannot be serviced by diesel generators, but are probably too small. Think Nova Scotia to have a large nuclear power plant deployed on its own. SMRs could really be a great opportunity to provide a power supply to provinces that need to decarbonize their electrical grids, but maybe cannot absorb the capacity of a large nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is starting to become, it's important in the provinces that still rely on fossil fuels, of course, but it could also start to become important in other provinces as well, as even today, hydro-rich provinces like Quebec are beginning to reconsider the future of nuclear power in their own provinces as hydro reliability starts to go down in the face of drought, and of course demand starts to go up as the economy electrifies. Mm-hmm. But beyond electricity, it gets really interesting when you start thinking about SMRs as heat machines. Nuclear reactors are fundamentally produce heat, and you use right. that heat to produce electricity. And industries that currently rely on fossil fuels to generate heat for their processes, think industries like petrochemicals, think industries like pulp and paper, which need to dry pulp, can really lean on SMRs to provide low carbon or zero carbon heat to their operations. That being said, not every industry will be SMR ready. There are some industries like cement, where process emissions that, that are created when you just as part of the manufacturing process, when you know you break when you make cement from limestone, that releases CO2. And these kinds of processes just cannot be decarbonized using small modular reactors. Right. There are others like blast furnaces for iron and steel, where the temperatures required are currently a little beyond what SMR designs can still provide. But for others, beachhead markets and petrochemicals, for example, SMRs could in the future become a very important way of providing zero emission heat. And there are already companies that are doing this, not in Canada yet, but the United States. A large petrochemical company is partnering up with a small modular reactor company to source zero carbon heat for one of their manufacturing facilities in Texas. And SMRs could really enable industries in other countries as well to start adopting them to decarbonize their operations. I'll move quickly into mining, which is another very interesting one for SMRs. And this has been something that has been talked about for a while. And where SMRs become valuable in the mining context is it allows mines that are far away from electrical grids to wean themselves off of diesel fuel and to kind of power their operations using a non-emitting power source. I should say that Canada is already doing well in terms of mining emissions. So Canadian gold mines, for example, are already the least emissions intensive amongst all gold mines around the world, thanks to grid interconnections and on-site renewable energy use. But for many of the mines that are far into the north, think nickel mines in northern Quebec and Labrador that currently rely on diesel, SMRs could really do a great job in helping those mines wean themselves off of diesel fuel in the future. There are challenges, of course, and SMRs, just to go back to the point that they are a new technology, there are challenges inherent in deploying them. First of all, like on the emissions front, some of Canada's largest emitting mines, the iron ore mines that you have in Quebec and Labrador, for example, and which rely on fossil fuels currently to process ore on site and then before shipping the ore off for further processing downstream, are unlikely to be able to use SMRs for that particular process. But for other ones, the potash sector, for example, is very intriguing because potash is directly, the mining process can be directly decarbonized using small modular reactors to displace natural gas use. And Canada, being one of the largest potash producers in the world, could really lean on SMRs to produce a low carbon commodity for export to other parts of the world. The big challenge is on the technical readiness side. SMRs are not quite there yet. It'll take a few more years before they are, the first units are built and proven to work. And therefore, before mining companies will be willing to take make an investment in putting an SMR on a mine site, or you know, contract a company out to bring SMR power to a mine. So it might take a little bit of time to get there, but eventually, I think SMRs could make a very tangible difference towards lowering mining emissions in Canada.
Right.
And I think the last kind of application that I'll speak about, which is pretty exciting, is the oil sands, decarbonizing the oil sands.
Right.
And where SMRs can be applied to oil sands decarbonization is in producing steam to pull bitumen out of the ground. I think about 12% of Canada's national emissions come from what is called in-situ oil sands extraction. So rather than mining oil sands from the surface, you extract oil which is underground by injecting steam into the ground and then pulling out a mixture of steam and oil and then further processing it. That process emits 12% of Canada's emissions and consumes about 30% of Canada's natural gas. So the emissions price is large. The natural gas displacement price is pretty large. And small modular reactors, because of their ability to produce high quality, consistent steam, can be used to just replace natural gas boilers on site at an oil sands facility. And we did a little bit of work to model what this would look like. And we found that depending on the kind of SMR in question, the specific nature of the design and the size of the oil sands facility, some of the largest emitting oil sands facilities in Canada could be decarbonized using a single SMR and displacing about five megatons of CO2 emissions. When will we see something like this? And that kind of brings us into like a challenge of deploying SMRs. We probably see grid scale SMRs very soon, hopefully, if construction and deployment of the first few go well, which by all indications they should. But for applications outside of the grid, where permitting has never been done before, right, where technology readiness needs to be demonstrated, we might see the applications of SMRs in these sectors being pushed down by a couple of years until the first couple of demonstrations have been achieved and the first results from these demonstration projects convince companies that SMRs are ready for industrial applications.
Yeah. So John, what does Canada need to be mindful of in order to help SMRs reach for their full potential in decarbonizing Canada and providing clean electricity?
So Vivan, I think, has very eloquently laid out the opportunities, but there are a number of considerations. Number one is the capital required, and how much of that will need to be public in some form, and how much will need to be private, and how do we track the private capital, particularly including international capital. We also have to think through the supply chain considerations. Ontario particularly has a very strong supply chain thanks to the history of CANDU, but the nuclear sector generally in the province that can become a bit of an export opportunity as well for the country. But the supply chain considerations include fuel sources, which Ron's report gets into. We're part of international agreements that try to limit the amount of nuclear fuel in the world for good reason, but the world is much more divided than it was, certainly in recent decades has been. So how do we ensure that we have security of supply for nuclear fuels? And at the other end, how do we think through nuclear waste? There's outstanding practices established in Canada, among the best in the world. And that's a credit to the industry. But as we scale this and take it to different parts of the country through all the opportunities that Vivan was laying out, how do we think through waste considerations and ensure that public confidence is maintained? It's impressive to me that the Canadian public is largely and increasingly on the side of nuclear development. I certainly remember a time when that was not the case. And that's not to be taken for granted. We need to continue to listen to communities, listen to different voices, and deal with them respectfully to maintain that. To maintain that confidence. And then connected to all that, which I think is a really interesting part of the opportunity, is Indigenous engagement. You may not think of indigenous territories when you think of nuclear reactors, for instance, but when you map out, literally when you map out both the areas that will be using SMRs and then the supply chains involved in them, it's and the transmission of the power,
right.
It very much implicates indigenous territories. And with that comes an opportunity for more equity, for more benefit sharing. But you know, we have to do that through very thoughtful approaches to consultation and consent, which we're getting better at as a country, but we'll need to ensure that that's a core part of any nuclear strategy as we grow.
That's a great summary of the report and some of the challenges. So a couple of months ago, you told me to kind of wait and see because you had more coming and this report was coming. So what's next? What can we expect next coming out of the Climate Action Institute?
Wow, you're asking us to reveal our secrets, but we try to genuinely open source a lot of our work and work with partners because this is for we hope for public benefit. We are working on some interesting policy ideas around industrial carbon pricing with others in the sector, and something that Canada needs to be mindful of, and related to that around trade measures. So lots of talk about carbon border adjustments, and now we're really getting geeky, but it's essentially, are there going to be trade barriers against higher carbon products, aluminum, steel come to mind. Europe is moving down that path. Yeah. Will an increasingly protectionist America say, okay, we're going to make it harder for high carbon aluminum or steel come into the United States? That can be an advantage for Canada, but we can't just say, hey, we're nice, take our word for it. We need rigorous pricing models as well as measurement models to ensure that the treatment of those industrial products, whether in the domestic market or foreign markets, is both transparent and market minded. So we'll have more on that. And then another project we're working on that might be greenhouses and the opportunity for Canada to grow what's already a really interesting and impressive little sector of, it's not so little anymore, of greenhouse food production. So we have amazing things going on in places like Leamington in southwestern Ontario.
Yep.
And that is probably going to be replicated in other parts of the country. But it's going to require more power, more electricity. And so how do we do that and do that in a climate-minded way? So stay tuned. There's lots of innovative approaches out there, and Canada has a chance to be a world leader in that, while feeding ourselves and doing that in a sustainable as well as an affordable way, which is, as we know, a key issue for many Canadians.
Okay, so we will. It doesn't look like we're likely to be at a loss of things to discuss in the weeks, months, and years ahead, from both just a general standpoint, but also from work coming out of the Climate Action Institute. That's great,
Francis. When the day comes when we have nothing to talk about, I really hope that day doesn't come, but it's not going to come anytime soon.
No, it's not coming anytime soon. That's for sure. Hey, but one of the things that I ask everybody, John, you know, you're aware of this. Everybody that comes on the podcast, we have our reading list. We call it the Flux Capacitor Book Club. Last time you were on the podcast, you added a book to the reading list. The book that you added last time was Vaclav Smil's book, How the World Really Works, which I thought was a terrific addition and a really good read. So why don't I turn to Vivan first? Vivan, is there a book that you would recommend for people to pick up and read?
I'm mindful of being on an electricity podcast and not knowing too many electricity books, but I'll try to name a couple of other reads which I've found quite enjoyable in the past in general. I have found that I think one thing that has stood out to me in my energy transition career so far has been the complexities of geopolitics.
Yeah.
and how much of an impact they have on our energy system and on our lives. And I think a book that I read not too long ago that laid out the current context of geopolitics very well and its implications on the energy system is Daniel Yergin's The New Map. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I'm a big fan of Yergin's work in general, and I think that's something that I would highly recommend that people pick up.
Outstanding. And what about you, John? Do you have another book to add to our book club?
Well, it's hard to follow that. I'm another Dan Yergin fan, but yeah. I'm reading Material World. It's the Ed Conway book about, I think it's the six materials that have changed the world: glass, steel, and so on. And it's kind of related to this conversation because it's fascinating to me to be reminded, but then taken much deeper into the energy requirements to create the materials that we take for granted, the chairs that we're sitting in, the glass that we drink from. We don't think of those as energy intensive. And as we talk about transitioning the energy system, well, if you want to drink water from a glass or from a plastic bottle or from anything, any mm-hmm. vessel, that's going to, and has for thousands of years, will require a fairly intense amount of energy.
Yeah.
So this is, again, part of the fascinating complexities of the energy transition. This isn't just about the fuel that you consume to drive somewhere or fly somewhere, the clothes that you wear, the things that you hold, the materials. So I love that word, the material world, because we have constructed quite literally and manufactured a material world that probably most of us enjoy and want to continue. But we get to take for granted the massive amounts of heat and energy
right.
required to produce all that we get to enjoy. So how are we going to do that in the decades ahead? And I think that's what your podcast gets to explore so wonderfully for all of us listeners.
Great. Okay. So our editions, well, we've got the New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations by Daniel Yergin, which had been recommended previously by somebody else on the podcast. So Vivan, you're moving it back up to the top of the reading list. That's awesome. And then John's recommendation, Material World, the Six Raw Materials That Shape Modern Civilization by Ed Conway. Two terrific, terrific additions. Vivan, John, I want to thank you for taking the time to join the podcast. Very, very interesting and a terrific update in terms of kind of the state of play of SMRs. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Francis, thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having us, Francis.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of The Flux Capacitor. Tune in for future episodes. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on X as Brad Bradley, and on Instagram as The Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page. This being episode 97. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Vivan's recommendation, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations by Daniel Yergin, and John's recommendation, Material World, The Six Raw Materials That Shape Modern Civilization by Ed Conway. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, on X, and at electricity.ca.